Let's go ahead and get started because this is all about on-shelf availability, and we know supply chain plays an important role with that. But before that, I think most people who are tuning in obviously know you already, but go ahead and, you know, go ahead and introduce yourself to us, to the listeners out there. You know, who is Dr. Waller, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, I'll do it very briefly since we've got a lot of good content to talk about today. So I'm Matt Waller. I'm Dean Emeritus of the Sam M. Walton College of Business. I was Dean for 8 years. Before that, I was an Associate Dean. And before that, I was Department Chair of Supply Chain Management. I also work in private equity to some degree. I work with a private equity firm called New Road Capital Partners that focuses primarily on supply chain technology, but they also look at retail and marketing technology as well. I've been a professor in the Walton College for a long time. My area is supply chain management, and I live in Northwest Arkansas. So thank you all for joining us.
Awesome. Well, here's the first question that I think people would love to know. You just finished a very impressive run as the Dean of the University of Arkansas Sam Walton Business School. So thank you for your service in that. We know that's a very different role than you've had before and probably you'll have in the future. But maybe give us a little bit of experience, you know, a look under the covers a little. What was that experience like? What did you really enjoy about it? Anything you want to share with us about, you know, your time as the dean of the business school?
Yeah, we during my 8 years as dean, I loved it. I loved working with the students, the faculty, the staff, the alumni, administrators from other colleges, the state of Arkansas, businesses in Arkansas. It was a wonderful time. One thing I did that I'll share that is a little unusual. When I started as dean, I decided to write a book about being a dean of a public business school. And part of the reason I did it was because when I became dean, I wasn't expecting to become dean, for one thing. And we had our current dean at the time had an offer to go back to his alma mater as dean there. And all of a sudden, I needed to be interim dean, and I really didn't know how to do it. There was no handbook or anything like that. But I wrote a book, and I want to mention it just because, I mean, most people listening to this wouldn't want to read it. It's called Dean's List, Leading a Modern Business School. But the reason I wrote it is kind of interesting. I thought if I write it, one, it'll help whoever follows me. But two, it will help me think, what do I want the end of the story to be? So writing, if I were ever to take another leadership position like this, I would write another book because it forces you to think strategically. Where do I want to go? How am I going to get there?
Mm-hmm.
It also forced me to, I went around as a new dean. I talked to other deans and said, who are the best business school deans in the country? And it's not always correlated to the best school necessarily. You know, who've been able to really lead these business schools to greater heights? Anyway, and so then I interviewed them and really enjoyed learning from them and implementing some of the things I learned. And so I put it together in a book. And now a lot of especially early stage business school deans call me because when they Google something about it, they find this. And I've also talked about it at some of our conferences, but that was really fun. One other thing I'll mention that's related to this, as you mentioned, Mike, every 2 years, Gartner ranks supply chain programs in the country. And I started the Department of Supply Chain Management in 2011. We didn't actually have a department. And in 2020, we got our first ranking of number one by Gartner. And Gartner is probably better than a lot of the rankings because they actually look at details like the curriculum, all kinds of other things. It's not just a beauty contest, if you will, like U.S. News and World Report. So we got that. They do it every 2 years. We got it 2 years, in a, two segments in a row, 20 and 2022. Our master's, our graduate program in supply chain is ranked number two by Gartner. We're trying to get that up to number one. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, yeah, being dean was a great experience, and I'm glad to be dean emeritus now.
Very good. Well, one of the things that I'm going to brag on you a little bit, and you're a very humble guy, so you'll hate this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Not only did you run that business school with style and grace and integrity, et cetera, but you did everything in your power to make sure it was handed off in a quality way. I mean, you personally spent, I don't know that this happened, but I feel like you personally handpicked Brent Williams at a very early stage and go, okay, you're going to walk this with me. So you don't just get thrown a set of keys like I did, but instead you get a nice long transition period in the amount of time and effort that you put into making sure this thing was going to continue to grow. You know, a lot of people don't do that. And I just want to thank you for that. And Brent's doing a great job, off to a tremendous start. And a lot of that is because I think you spent the time up front to make sure. I don't know if you know Chip Berg from Adidas. Levi's. Him and I used to work with together with P&G, and they had a one-year CEO transition with the new CEO. 1 year.
Smart.
It's unheard of in the industry.
It is, yeah.
But it's like, we're going to basically do this together for a year, and we'll give you pieces at a time. And I think it's just a really, really, really smart to be able to do that. So I've got a couple things that we're going to talk about supply chain, because the purpose of this is really to talk about, you know, sort of the supply chain. And we're going to spend some time about the supply chain, and certainly as it relates to what I would consider to be the topic of this podcast, which is basically on-shelf availability. And I put this up here first, Dr. Waller, and this is fascinating to me, right? So this is Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, and his quote, "It's really simple. If you're not meeting the wants and needs of the customer, you're done. You are done. There's not a lot of loyalty here." And as we've talked, Matt Pfeiffer, several times on the podcast, this thing here ultimately puts the decision of what do I want to get a hold of in the customer's hand. So loyalty is not to a Walmart or to an Amazon, et cetera. It's I want to get that product. How can I get it? And how do I leverage this technology to do this? And that to me is why on-shelf availability is so important. While Doug doesn't call that out, if I consistently go to Walmart and my stuff that I'm looking for is not there, I'm going somewhere else, right? Number two, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, you should probably send this to Brent or Brian at the supply chain, which is was at one point in time, I don't know if it still is, on Doug McMillon's screensaver. So every time he opened up his phone, this is what he saw. And it's a story of you work really hard to become number one. Once you stop becoming number one, it's really hard to recover. You know, 1950, 1960, 1970, Sears is the number one retailer. 2017, they're not even on the list anymore, right? So, you know, that constant, how do we continue to improve even though we're the best? How do we make sure we market and tell people the story? I think is really, really, really important. But to me, these are the kinds of things that I think keep Walmart up at night, which is just making sure they have product either in a store or available for online picking so customers aren't disappointed. One other quick fact that I'll tell you is this is something that was done by Tony D'Onofrio, and he did a lot of research on this, but I'm not going to go through all of this. But in 2023, $1.7 trillion of inventory disruption. What's that mean? That means your inventory is inaccurate or you have out of stocks. So 68% of that 1.7 trillion is out of stocks and the other is overstocks, right? That's a big number. That's a big, big number. Then we get into reasons why and et cetera, et cetera. But what you'll end up seeing is the supply chain plays a big role in on-shelf availability. There are three things that I have taught. I try to make it really, really simple. There are three reasons why product's not in the store. Number one, store operations, which means it's in the store somewhere, but it's probably in the back room. So for the customer, it's not available. Number two, the bottom one, we've got this whole perpetual inventory. And Dr. Waller, you and I have talked about this a long time, that on-hand accuracy and the accuracy of information to feed a forecast and a replenishment system. garbage in, garbage out. If you have bad data that you're sending to the replenishment system, you're probably not going to get really, really good results. So those two, we've really talked at length in this particular podcast, but this is the one I want to focus on today. It's now 2024. Let's talk about the supply chain, because at the end of the day, if there's not product in the store to put on the shelf, everybody says it's a supply chain issue.
What really started this, to some degree, were consumer reactions that were odd, like, you know, hoarding toilet paper and things like that. But the bigger issue in the supply chain really came from the stimulus of the government. You know, the government put so much money into the economy, and that stimulus is what caused most of the supply chain problems. Some people will say, well, it revealed the problems, but I don't think that's true completely. Part of my reason for that is, you know, you have to rationally run a supply chain to minimize costs and meet service levels. And who would guess that the federal government would put that much money into the economy? They were guessing. And at the same time, the interest rates were really low. And so we do still have problems. You know, a lot of times when we talk about, yeah, there were a lot of stockouts during that time frame, but there were also a lot of excess inventory as well, right? You can have two products in the same retail supply chain and have some product that you have too much of and others that you don't have enough of. And still, a lot of retailers and suppliers don't have visibility to their inventory, and that's a key part of the problem. The other thing I would say is there's two effects that I wanted to mention. And one is that, you know, everyone hears about the bullwhip effect, and that was brought up. I don't think it was the biggest problem for what happened during the pandemic. And the pandemic didn't cause the problems in the supply chain. The stimulus is what caused most of the problems. But in any case, people, just to clarify, bullwhip was present and it was part of the problem, but there's another concept I'll mention people may not be aware of. But the bullwhip effect, which does have a lot of people have talked a lot about it, it basically says this: order variability, order variance in particular, increases as you go up the supply chain. So the variability of orders at the retail supply chain is smaller than the variability at much higher levels, echelons in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So if you start having greater variability at a low level, it gets translated into even greater variability at a high level in the supply chain. However, capacity constraints chop off those peaks, if you will. And so when you look at a whole supply chain and an economy, it's not as great as you might expect from a pure theoretical perspective of the bullwhip effect. What was a bigger cause of some of the problems is something called the inventory acceleration phenomena. And that is, and it's a real simple idea. You know, when demand is real level, it can be uncertain, but you know what the average is over time. You can forecast it really well. You replenish on average at a one-to-one level. You know, you're not ordering at a one-to-one level, but your replenishment is at about a one-to-one level. You may be ordering case packs instead of eaches, but it's still a one-to-one kind of an idea. But when demand starts increasing, replenishment gets notched up to more than a one-to-one level, right? You have to be able to have enough safety stock and to take advantage of economies of scale and transportation. So, if you're ordering at greater than a one-to-one level, the next echelon above you, the distribution center, is going to do the same thing, and it's going to order another greater than one-to-one level. Mm-hmm. And that will keep happening as you go up the supply chain. So the orders start getting amplified, and people aren't aware of necessarily how much they're being amplified and what the implications are if demand decreases. So when demand decreases, the inventory accelerator phenomena would say that instead of ordering the one-to-one level, you go to less than one-to-one level. That happens through the whole supply chain as well. So that can also result in stockouts. But both of those things did have a part to play in it. Capacity constraints had a part to play. And then on the demand side, people were, not just people, but even organizations were over-ordering so that they would have enough inventory, maybe more than their competitors.
So if it's 2018 right now, and we know 2020 is coming, what could we have done to minimize? We're going to have out of stocks, right? We're not, with all this years of just-in-time inventories and trying to drive down inventory levels of various stock, the pandemic created demand both through incentives that you said, as well as people just hoarding cleaning supplies, et cetera. What could we have done other than maybe not provided an incentive to drive demand up, which probably compounded the problem? What could we have done if that happens again? I hope not, but if it happens again in 2026, how do we prevent what we saw in 2020 happening? Are we any smarter than we were before?
In some ways, I think we are smarter in the sense that, for example, on the transportation side, I think at the store level, I'm not sure. I still think there's a lack of visibility throughout the supply chain. At the retail level, across retail. Some retailers have a lot more visibility than others, but yep. You need visibility. You need to know what's going on to be able to respond to it, obviously. You don't want to respond after everything's out of stock, you know.
Right.
But I think that, some things that are better is that we have because more shoppers are using things like buy online, pick up at store, mm-hmm. buy online delivery, buy online in home, et cetera, you're getting more visibility to consumer behavior.
Right.
So I think that will help. In the transportation area, there are platforms. For example, if you look at truckload transportation, there's platforms out there now like there's a company called Emerge, and they have a platform that helps kind of marry supply and demand for truckload transportation. There's a wider variety of technologies, early stage technologies that, they say necessity is the mother of invention. Well, there's all kinds of innovations that have come out of this in the supply chain. But there's also technologies out there that existed prior to this, but no one realized they needed them until after it already happened.
Right.
So those are some things that but in terms of the government, so it depends on, for a government, the government's probably overreacted from a stimulus perspective. And a lot of times the stimulus went places that it shouldn't have gone. Mm. And now we have a bunch of debt. And because we have a bunch of debt, the interest rates had to increase. And the interest rates are causing additional problems. Businesses have trouble planning when they don't know what the interest rate's going to be and when they don't know what the prices are going to be. So, mm-hmm. From a planning perspective in a business, inflation, and that video you showed really highlighted this. It's very hard to plan and execute when you're in an inflationary environment. And of course, our inflation never was as bad as, say, what they experienced in Argentina mm-hmm. or somewhere like that. But basically, inflation is always caused by the same thing. Mm-hmm. And people kept saying, okay, the supply chain constraints are causing inflation. A lot of the empirical research is not showing that. Inflation is caused by government spending, printing money. That is what causes inflation. And in this case, so the government spending caused stockouts, which caused supply chain problems, which caused inflation. So you had a double whammy from an inflation perspective. And now interest rates are high.
Yep.
When interest rates go up, money, people won't put as much money into equities, whether they be in private markets or public markets. And equity is what causes innovation to grow. And innovation is one of the greatest ways to reduce inflation and to increase wealth of people. So I think that, you know, if the government were rational, and they're not, they would, if they knew it was coming in 2018, they wouldn't have created all these, maybe some stimulus, but not to the degree they did. And they might try to hold interest rates constant. It's like, if we just know what interest rates are, we can plan. If they're going all over the board, we have no way to plan.
Right.
And so those are, I think the government could have allowed for a more stable environment, is what I would say. But we also need to be investing. The government needs to be investing, instead of just stimulus handouts to people, they need to be investing in infrastructure. We have bridges that are dilapidated.
Yeah.
Our electric grid, something like 50% of our electric grid is over its expected life.
Wow.
Our electric grid's a big problem. We need lots of investment in the electric grid and in other things.
Interesting. So they could have potentially repurposed that money that they were going to give to instead to drive demand, which probably already was there some demand there, instead of to invest in the infrastructure to support what we need to do.
Yeah.
You mentioned something a second ago about, so let's forget about the global pandemic, because that was in the past. We learned a lot of stuff. You mentioned the bullwhip effect, and lots of people on the line have already heard bullwhip effect and heard that forever, but it's basically demand at the consumption level is pretty flat, and in every stage of the logistics coming more and more and more and more. We've been talking about the bullwhip effect. I remember when I was in college, we talked about the bullwhip effect. Have we fundamentally flattened out that bullwhip effect? And if not, what are some of the either processes or capabilities need to put in place? Because to me, having visibility of all items in the supply chain, across the supply chain, so manufacturers knew exactly what was in the stores and exactly what were in the retailer DCs and exactly in their DCs, it certainly wouldn't have helped the global pandemic because there was just too much demand. But we still have these little pockets. Everybody knows where their stuff is, but nobody knows end-to-end where stuff is located. Is that an opportunity for the industry to figure this thing out? Because we've been talking about the bullwhip forever.
Yeah, so the bullwhip effect can be mitigated through information. There's no question about that. But even problems associated with what I mentioned earlier, the inventory acceleration effect, that can also be mitigated with more information about product position, where, you know, frequency, rate of demand, all these kind of things. So, but you've got to be able to take that information and plan with it too. It's not enough to just have the information.
Right.
You've got to be able to make plans with it. So yeah, I think that right now there's still surprisingly a lack of availability of information. And the more information we have, the easier it will be to plan. But if we were to get that information, these companies are going to need tools to be able to plan with this information.
Right, right. Yeah, not to talk us all the way through the end of the story, but, you know, my 40 years in the industry, the way we transfer information from one entity to another is typically using electronic data interchange, which technology's been around for 50 years, right?
Yep.
With the massive amount of information that's now out there, that's a lot more information than I think is suitable for that kind of transactional platform. There was a lot of talk probably a couple of years ago. It started tailed off a little bit about this idea of a blockchain where everybody had insights Where is that really? And by the way, I'm probably catching you off guard because I don't think we talked about this question ahead of time.
No, that's fine.
Blockchain to me was kind of the epitome. It was going to be able to share information privately and you'd know everything in the supply chain, et cetera. And you don't hear that much about it anymore.
I believe, well, if you think about it, right, back in the 90s, when the internet's been around a long time.
Right.
But when the World Wide Web came out in the 90s, and at first it was just pushing information, right? And then eventually you got to the point where you could order things, buy things, and make transactions. Mm-hmm. PayPal came out, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a time, if you remember, at the end of the dot-com boom, the dot-com bust, everyone said, oh, this was all hype. People thought that e-commerce was hype. Mm-hmm. Over a decade past then.
Right.
Right. I think the same thing's true with blockchain. I am still very bullish on blockchain. Okay. I believe that one of the challenges with blockchain right now has to do with visibility and knowing when product is moved around. You can't have the blockchain doesn't work as well if there's manual entry of information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're using technologies like RFID as an example, and more broadly in the supply chain, where movement can be captured immediately, then smart contracts can be written based on that movement and executed. I still think this is coming.
Yeah.
This will happen. I don't know if it's going to take 5 years or 20 years, but I know this. All technology implementation is increasing. And what I mean by that is what used to take 30 years to be introduced has continued to decrease in time.
Right.
But I'm still very bullish on blockchain.
Okay. Well, I think the other thing that's coming along, and I don't want to derail this conversation, but I know I've talked this on a podcast with GS1 as well as with Myron Burke, last month, the whole idea of serialized data. So I've got, two pins. They both have the same UPC, but this one's serial number one and this one's serial number two. It's foundational in RFID. That gives me the ability to know this one sold and this one did not sell. It's just really, really, really powerful. It has all kinds of asset protection use cases as well. What did I receive versus what did I pay for? Because I can literally identify each one of these uniquely. I think as I've talked to people like Justin Patton from Auburn and Dr. Hargrave from the University of Memphis, we still struggle with most legacy systems inside a retail and manufacturer is still UPC quantity. So how do you get down to that next level? That's going to be the big challenge. And blockchain may be an example of that. EPCIS, which is an RFID data sharing platform, may be it. We're going to have to figure out this out because it feels like we're still running into the same problems over and over again. And I do know that, when we did the Auburn study, the chip project, if you will, multiple billions of dollars of claims and shrinkages and counterfeit product, it's still a problem out there in the industry, and we still haven't figured out a way to solve that. We really need some industry leadership to kind of help figure out what that future looks like for sure. So good. If you're still bullish on blockchain, because just personally, it was a whole bunch of excitement a couple of years ago, and now it's kind of fittered away. So hopefully people are still looking at that because I think it's a real mechanism.
Warren Buffett, one of his famous quotes is, when everyone's greedy, be cautious. Everyone's cautious, be greedy.
Ooh, that's good.
I think that's true right now with blockchain technologies.
Interesting.
And with RFID and other kinds of technologies. Internet of Things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.